The End of Eternity by Isaac Asimov. Narrated by Paul Bamer.
Chapter 1. Technician. Andrew Harlan stepped into the kettle. Its sides were perfectly round, and it fit snugly inside a vertical shaft composed of widely spaced rods that shimmered into an unseeable haze 6 feet above Harlan's head. Harlan set the controls and moved the smoothly working starting lever. The kettle did not move. Harlan did not expect it to. He expected no movement, neither up nor down, left nor right, forth nor back. Yet the spaces between the rods had melted into a gray blankness which was solid to the touch, though nonetheless immaterial for all that. And there was the little stir in his stomach, the faint, psychosomatic, touch of dizziness that told him that all the kettle contained, including himself, was rushing upwind through eternity. He had boarded the kettle in the 575th century, the base of operations assigned him 2 years earlier. At the time, the 575th had been the farthest up when he had ever traveled. Now, he was moving up when to the 2456th century. Under ordinary circumstances, he might have felt a little lost at the prospect. His native century was in the far down when, the 95th century to be exact. The 95th was a century stiffly restrictive of atomic power, faintly rustic, fond of natural wood as a structural material, exporters of certain types of distilled potables to nearly every when, and importers of clover seed. Although Harlan had not been in the 95th since he entered special training and became a cub at the age of 15, there was always that feeling of loss when one moved out when from home. At the 2456th, he would be nearly 240 millennia from his birth when, and that is a sizable distance, even for a hardened eternal. Under ordinary circumstances, all this would be so. But right now, Harlan was in poor mood to think of anything but the fact that his documents were heavy in his pocket and tense, a little confused. It was his hands acting by themselves that brought the kettle to the proper halt at the proper century. Strange that a technician should feel tense or nervous about anything. What was it that educator Yarrow had once said? Above all, a technician must be dispassionate. The reality change he initiates may affect the lives of as many as 50 billion people. A million or more of these may be so drastically affected as to be considered new individuals. Under these conditions, an emotional makeup is a distinct handicap. Harlan put the memory of his teacher's dry voice out of his mind with an almost savage shake of his head. In those days, he had never imagined that he himself would have the peculiar talent for that very position. But emotion had come upon him after all. Not for 50 billion people. What in time did he care for 50 billion people? There was just one. One person. He became aware that the kettle was stationary, and with the merest pause to pull his thoughts together, put himself into the cold, impersonal frame of mind a technician must have. He stepped out. The kettle he left, of course, was not the same as the one he had boarded, in the sense that it was not composed of the same atoms. He did not worry about that any more than any eternal would. To concern oneself with the mystique of time travel, rather than with the simple fact of it, was the mark of the cub and newcomer to eternity. He paused again at the infinitely thin curtain of non-space and non-time, which separated him from eternity in one way, and from ordinary time in another. This would be a completely new section of eternity for him. He knew about it in a rough way, of course, having checked upon it in the temporal handbook. Still, there was no substitute for actual appearance, and he steeled himself for the initial shock of adjustment. He adjusted the controls, a simple matter in passing into eternity, and a very complicated one in passing into time, a type of passage which was correspondingly less frequent. He stepped through the curtain and found himself squinting at the brilliance. Automatically, he threw up his hand to shield his eyes. Only one man faced him. At first, Harlan could see him only blurrily. The man said, "I am sociologist Cantervoy. I imagine you are technician Harlan." Harlan nodded and said, "Father Time, isn't this sort of ornamentation adjustable?" Voy looked about and said tolerantly, "You mean the molecular films?"
"I certainly do," said Harlan.
The handbook had mentioned them, but had said nothing of such an insane riot of light reflection. Harlan felt his annoyance to be quite reasonable. The 2456th century was matter-oriented, as most centuries were, so he had a right to expect a basic compatibility from the very beginning. It would have none of the utter confusion, for anyone born matter-oriented, of the energy vortices of the 300s or the field dynamics of the 600s. In the 2456th, to the average eternal's comfort, matter was used for everything from walls to tacks. To be sure, there was matter and matter. A member of an energy-oriented century might not realize that. To him, all matter might seem minor variations on the theme that was gross, heavy, and barbaric. To matter-oriented Harlan, however, there was wood, metal, subdivisions heavy and light, plastic, silicates, concrete, leather, and so on. But matter consisting entirely of mirrors. That was his first impression of the 2456th. Every surface reflected and glinted light. Everywhere was the illusion of complete smoothness, the effect of a molecular film, and in the ever-repeated reflection of himself, of sociologist Voy, of everything he could see, in scraps and holes, in all angles, there was confusion. Garish confusion and nausea.
"I'm sorry," said Voy. "It's the custom of the century, and the section assigned to it finds it good practice to adopt the customs where practical. You get used to it after a time."
Voy walked rapidly upon the moving feet of another Voy, upside down beneath the floor, who matched him stride for stride. He reached to move a hair contact indicator down a spiral scale to point of origin. The reflections died. Extraneous light faded. Harlan felt his world settle.
"If you'll come with me now," said Voy.
Harlan followed through empty corridors that, Harlan knew, must moments ago have been a riot of made light and reflection, up a ramp, through an anteroom, into an office. In all the short journey, no human being had been visible. Harlan was so used to that, took it so for granted, that he would have been surprised, almost shocked, if a glimpse of a human figure hurrying away had caught his eyes. No doubt the news had spread that a technician was coming through. Even Voy kept his distance, and when, accidentally, Harlan's hand had brushed Voy's sleeve, Voy shrank away with a visible start. Harlan was faintly surprised at the touch of bitterness he felt at this. He had thought the shell he had grown about his soul was thicker, more efficiently insensitive than that. If he was wrong, if his shell had worn thinner, there could only be one reason for that. Noyes. Sociologist Cantervoy leaned forward toward the technician in what seemed a friendly enough fashion,
but Harlan noted automatically that they were seated on opposite sides of the long axis of a fairly large table. Voy said, "I am pleased to have a technician of your reputation interest himself in our little problem here." "Yes," said Harlan, with the cold impersonality people would expect of him. "It has its points of interest." Was he impersonal enough? Surely his real motives must be apparent, his guilt be spelled out in beads of sweat on his forehead. He removed from an inner pocket the foiled summary of the projected reality change. It was the very copy which had been sent to the All-When Council a month earlier. Through his relationship with Senior Computer Twistle, the Twistle himself, Harlan had had little trouble in getting his hands on it. Before unrolling the foil, letting it peel off onto the tabletop where it would be held by a soft paramagnetic field, Harlan paused a split moment. The molecular film that covered the table was subdued, but was not zero. The motion of his arm fixed his eye, and for an instant the reflection of his own face seemed to stare somberly up at him from the tabletop. He was 32, but he looked older. He needed no one to tell him that. It might be partly his long face and dark eyebrows over darker eyes that gave him the lowering expression and cold glare associated with the caricature of the technician in the minds of all Eternals. It might be just his own realization that he was a technician. But then he flicked the foil out across the table and turned to the matter at hand. "I am not a sociologist, sir." Voy smiled. "That sounds formidable. When one begins by expressing lack of competence in a given field, it usually implies that a flat opinion in that field will follow almost immediately." "No," said Harlan, "not an opinion. Just a request. I wonder if you won't look over this summary and see if you haven't made a small mistake somewhere here." Voy looked instantly grave. "I hope not," he said. Harlan kept one arm across the back of his chair, the other in his lap. He must let neither hand drum restless fingers. He must not bite his lips. He must not show his feelings in any way. Ever since the whole orientation of his life had so changed itself, he had been watching the summaries of projected reality changes as they passed through the grinding administrative gears of the All-When Council. As Senior Computer Twistle's personally assigned technician, he could arrange that by a slight bending of professional ethics, particularly with Twistle's attention caught ever more tightly in his own overwhelming project. Harlan's nostrils flared. He knew now a little of the nature of that project. Harlan had had no assurance that he would ever find what he was looking for in a reasonable time. When he had first glanced over projected reality change 2456 to 2781, serial number V5, he was half inclined to believe his reasoning powers were warped by wishing. For a full day, he had checked and rechecked equations and relationships in a rattling uncertainty, mixed with growing excitement and a bitter gratitude that he had been taught at least elementary psychomathematics. Now, Voy went over those same puncture patterns with a half-puzzled, half-worried eye. He said, "It seems to me, I say it seems to me, that this is all perfectly in order." Harlan said, "I refer you particularly to the matter of the courtship characteristics of the society of the current reality of this century. That's sociology, and your responsibility, I believe. It's why I arranged to see you when I arrived, rather than someone else." Voy was now frowning. He was still polite, but with an icy touch now. He said, "The observers assigned to our section are highly competent. I have every certainty that those assigned to this project have given accurate data.
Have you evidence to the contrary?
Not at all, sociologist boy. I accept their data. It is the development of the data I question. Do you not have an alternate tensor complex at this point, if the courtship data is taken properly into consideration? Voy stared, and then a look of relief washed over him visibly.
Of course, technician, of course. But it resolves itself into an identity. There is a loop of small dimensions with no tributaries on either side. I hope you'll forgive me for using picturesque language rather than precise mathematical expressions.
I appreciate it, said Harlan dryly. I am no more a computer than a sociologist.
Very good, then. The alternate tensor complex you refer to, or the forking of the road, as we might say, is non-significant. The forks join up again, and it is a single road. There was not even any need to mention it in our recommendations.
If you say so, sir, I will defer to your better judgment. However, there is still the matter of the MNC. The sociologist winced at the initials, as Harlan knew he would. MNC, minimum necessary change. There, the technician was master. A sociologist might consider himself above criticism by lesser beings in anything involving the mathematical analysis of the infinite possible realities in time. But in matters of MNC, the technician stood supreme. Mechanical computing would not do. The largest computerplex ever built, manned by the cleverest and most experienced senior computer ever born, could do no better than to indicate the ranges in which the MNC might be found. It was then the technician, glancing over the data, who decided on an exact point within that range. A good technician was rarely wrong. A top technician was never wrong. Harlan was never wrong. Now, the MNC recommended, said Harlan. He spoke coolly, evenly, pronouncing the standard intertemporal language in precise syllables. By your section, involves induction of an accident in space and the immediate death by fairly horrible means of a dozen or more men.
Unavoidable, said Voy, shrugging.
On the other hand, said Harlan, I suggest that the MNC can be reduced to the mere displacement of a container from one shelf to another. Here. His long finger pointed. His white, well-cared-for index nail made the faintest mark along one set of perforations. Voy considered matters with a painful but silent intensity. Harlan said, doesn't that alter the situation with regard to your unconsidered fork? Doesn't it take advantage of the fork of lesser probability, changing it to a near certainty? And does that not then lead to...
To virtually the MDR,
whispered Voy. To exactly the maximum desired response, said Harlan. Voy looked up, his dark face struggling somewhere between chagrin and anger. Harlan noted absently that there was a space between the man's large upper incisors, which gave him a rabbity look, quite at odds with the restrained force of his words. Voy said,
I suppose I will be hearing from the Alwyn Council?
I don't think so. As far as I know, the Alwyn Council does not know of this. At least, the projected reality change was passed over to me without comment. He did not explain the word passed, nor did Voy question it.
You discovered this error, then?
Yes.
And you did not report it to the Alwyn Council?
No, I did not. Relief first, then a hardening of countenance.
Why not?
Very few people could have avoided this error. I felt I could correct it before damage was done. I have done so. Why go any further?
Well, thank you, Technician Harlan. You have been a friend. The section's error, which, as you say, was practically unavoidable, would have looked unjustifiably bad in the record.
He went on after a moment's pause.
Of course, in view of the alterations in personality to be induced by this reality change, the death of a few men as preliminary is of little importance.
Harlan thought, detachedly, he doesn't sound really grateful. He probably resents it. If he stops to think, he'll resent it even more, this being saved a downstroke in rating by a technician. If I were a sociologist, he would shake my hand, but he won't shake the hand of a technician. He defends condemning a dozen people to asphyxiation, but he won't touch a technician. And because waiting to let resentment grow would be fatal, Harlan said, without waiting, "I hope your gratitude will extend to having your section perform a slight chore for me."
"A chore?"
"A matter of life plotting. I have the data necessary here with me. I have also the data for a suggested reality change in the 482nd. I want to know the effect of the change on the probability pattern of a certain individual."
"I am not quite sure," said the sociologist slowly, "that I understand you. Surely you have the facilities for doing this in your own section?"
"I have. Nevertheless, what I am engaged in is a personal research, which I don't wish to appear in the records just yet. It would be difficult to have this carried out in my own section without..." He gestured an uncertain conclusion to the unfinished sentence.
Voy said, "Then you want this done not through official channels?"
"I want it done confidentially. I want a confidential answer."
"Well now, that's very irregular. I can't agree to it."
Harlan frowned. "No more irregular than my failure to report your error to the All-Wen Council. You raised no objection to that. If we're going to be strictly regular in one case, we must be as strict and as regular in the other. You follow me, I think?" The look on Voy's face was proof positive of that. He held out his hand.
"May I see the documents?"
Harlan relaxed a bit. The main hurdle had been passed. He watched eagerly as the sociologist's head bent over the foils he had brought. Only once did the sociologist speak.
"By time, this is a small reality change."
Harlan seized his opportunity and improvised. "It is. Too small, I think. It's what the argument is about. It's below critical difference, and I've picked an individual as a test case. Naturally, it would be undiplomatic to use our own section's facilities until I was certain of being right." Voy was unresponsive, and Harlan stopped. No use running this past the point of safety. Voy stood up.
"I'll pass this along to one of my life plotters. We'll keep this private. You understand, though, that this is not to be taken as establishing a precedent?"
"Of course not."
"And if you don't mind, I'd like to watch the reality change take place. I trust you will honor us by conducting the MNC personally?"
Harlan nodded. "I will take full responsibility." Two of the screens in the viewing chamber were in operation when they entered. The engineers had focused them already to the exact coordinates, in space and time, and then had left. Harlan and Voy were alone in the glittering room. The molecular film arrangement was perceptible, and even a bit more than perceptible, but Harlan was looking at the screens. Both views were motionless. They might have been scenes of the dead, since they pictured mathematical instants of time. One view was in sharp, natural color, the engine room of what Harlan knew to be an experimental spaceship. A door was closing, and a glistening shoe of a red, semi-transparent material was just visible through the space that remained. It did not move. Nothing moved. If the picture could have been made sharp enough to picture the dust motes in the air, they would not have moved. Voy said,
"For 2 hours and 36 minutes after the viewed instant, that engine room will remain empty. In the current reality, that is."
"I know," murmured Harlan. He was putting on his gloves, and already his quick eyes were memorizing the position of the critical container on its shelf, measuring the steps to it, estimating the best position into which to transfer it. He cast one quick look at the other screen. If the engine room, being in the range described as present with respect to that section of eternity in which they now stood, was clear and in natural color, the other scene, being some 25 centuries in the future, carried the blue luster all views of the future must. It was a spaceport. A deep blue sky, blue-tinged buildings of naked metal on blue-green ground. A blue cylinder of odd design, bulge-bottomed, stood in the foreground. Two others like it were in the background. All three pointed cleft noses upward, the cleavage biting deeply into the vitals of the ship. Harlan frowned. They're queer ones.
Electrogravitic, said Voy. The 2481st is the only century to develop electrogravitic space travel. No propellants, no nucleonics. It's an aesthetically pleasing device. It's a pity we must change away from it, a pity.
His eyes fixed themselves on Harlan with distinct disapproval. Harlan's lips compressed.
Disapproval, of course. Why not? He was the technician.
To be sure, it had been some observer who had brought in the details of drug addiction. It had been some statistician who had demonstrated that recent changes had increased the addiction rate until now it was the highest in all the current reality of man. Some sociologist, probably Voy himself, had interpreted that into the psychiatric profile of a society. Finally, some computer had worked out the reality change necessary to decrease addiction to a safe level and found that, as a side effect, electrogravitic space travel must suffer.
100 men of every rating in eternity had had a hand in this.
But then, at the end, a technician such as himself must step in. Following the directions all the others had combined to give him, he must be the one to initiate the actual reality change. And then, all the others would stare in haughty accusation at him. Their stares would say, "You, not we, have destroyed this beautiful thing." And for that, they would condemn and avoid him. They would shift their own guilt to his shoulders and scorn him. Harlan said harshly, "Ships aren't what count. We're concerned with those things." The things were people, dwarfed by the spaceship, as Earth and Earth's society is always dwarfed by the physical dimensions of spaceflight. They were little puppets in clusters, these people. Their tiny arms and legs were in raised, artificial-looking positions, caught in the frozen instant of time. Voy shrugged. Harlan was adjusting the small field generator about his left wrist.
Let's get this job done.
1 minute. I want to get in touch with the life plotter and find out how long his job for you will take. I want to get that job done, too.
His hands worked cleverly at a little movable contact, and his ear listened astutely to the pattern of clicks that came back. Another characteristic of this section of eternity, thought Harlan. Sound codes in clicks. Clever, but affected, like the molecular films.
He says it won't take more than 3 hours, said Voy at length. Also, by the way, he admires the name of the person involved. Noyes Lambent. It is a female, isn't it?
There was a dryness in Harlan's throat.
Yes.
Voy's lips curled into a slow smile.
Sounds interesting. I'd like to meet her, sight unseen. Haven't had any women in this section for months.
Harlan didn't trust himself to answer. He stared a moment at the sociologist and turned abruptly. If there was a flaw in eternity, it involved women. He had known the flaw for what it was from almost his first entrance into eternity, but he felt it personally only that day he had first met Noyes. From that moment, it had been an easy path to this one, in which he stood false to his oath as an Eternal and to everything in which he had believed. For what? For Noyes. And he was not ashamed.
It was that which really rocked him.
He was not ashamed. He felt no guilt for the crescendo of crimes he had committed, to which this latest edition of the unethical use of confidential life-plotting could rank only as a peccadillo. He would do worse than his worst if he had to. For the first time the specific and express thought came to him, and though he pushed it away in horror, he knew that, having once come, it would return. The thought was simply this, that he would ruin eternity if he had to. The worst of it was that he knew he had the power to do it.
Chapter 2. Observer. Harlan stood at the gateway to time and thought of himself in new ways. It had been very simple once. There were such things as ideals, or at least catchwords to live by and for. Every stage of an Eternal's life had a reason. How did basic principles start? The life of an Eternal may be divided into four parts. It all worked out neatly, yet it had all changed for him, and what was broken could not be made whole again. Yet he had gone faithfully through each of the four parts of an Eternal's life. First, there was the period of 15 years in which he was not an Eternal at all, but only an inhabitant of time. Only a human being out of time, a timer, could become an Eternal. No one could be born into the position. At the age of 15, he was chosen by a careful process of elimination and winnowing, the nature of which he had no conception of at the time. He was taken beyond the veil of eternity after a last, agonized farewell to his family. Even then, it was made clear to him that whatever else happened, he would never return. The true reason for that, he was not to learn till long afterward. Once within eternity, he spent 10 years in school as a cub, and then graduated to enter his third period as observer. It was only after that that he became a specialist and a true Eternal. The fourth and last part of the Eternal's life, timer, cub, observer, and specialist. He, Harlan, had gone through it all so neatly. He might say, successfully. He could remember so clearly the moment that cubhood was done, the moment they became independent members of eternity, the moment when, even though unspecialized, they still rated the legal title of Eternal. He could remember it. School done, cubhood over, he was standing with the five who completed training with him, hands clasped in the small of his back, legs a trifle apart, eyes front, listening. Educator Yarrow was at a desk talking to them. Harlan could remember Yarrow well, a small, intense man with ruddy hair in disarray, freckled forearms, and a look of loss in his eyes. It wasn't uncommon, this look of loss in the eyes of an Eternal, the loss of home and roots, the unadmitted and unadmittable longing for the one century he could never see. Harlan could not remember Yarrow's exact words, of course, but the substance of it remained sharp. Yarrow said, in substance, "You will be observers now. It isn't a highly regarded position. Specialists look upon it as a boy's job. Maybe you Eternals." He deliberately paused after that word to give each man a chance to straighten his back and brighten at the glory of it. "Think so too. If so, you are fools who don't deserve to be observers. The computers would have no computing to do, life plotters no lives to plot, sociologists no societies to profile. None of the specialists would have anything to do if it weren't for the observer.
I know you've heard this said before, but I want you to be very firm and clear in your mind about it. It will be you youngsters who will go out into time under the most strenuous conditions to bring back facts. Cold, objective facts, uncolored by your own opinions and likings, you understand. Facts accurate enough to be fed into computing machines. Facts definite enough to make the social equations stand up. Facts honest enough to form a basis for reality changes. And remember this too. Your period as observer is not something to get through with as quickly and as unobtrusively as possible. It is as an observer that you will make your mark. Not what you did in school, but what you will do as an observer will determine your specialty and how high you will rise in it. This will be your postgraduate course, Eternals, and failure in it, even small failure, will put you into maintenance no matter how brilliant your potentialities now seem. That is all. He shook hands with each of them, and Harlan, grave, dedicated, proud in his belief that the privileges of being an Eternal contained its greatest privilege in the assumption of responsibility for the happiness of all the human beings who were or ever would be within the reach of eternity, was deep in self-awe. Harlan's first assignments were small and under close direction, but he sharpened his ability on the honing strap of experience in a dozen centuries through a dozen reality changes. In his fifth year as observer, he was given a senior's rating in the field and assigned to the 482nd. For the first time, he would be working unsupervised, and knowledge of that fact robbed him of some of his self-assurance when he first reported to the computer in charge of the section. That was assistant computer Hob Finge, whose pursed, suspicious mouth and frowning eyes seemed ludicrous in such a face as his. He had a round button of a nose, two larger buttons of cheeks. He needed only a touch of red and a fringe of white hair to be converted into the picture of the primitive myth of St. Nicholas, or Santa Claus, or Kris Kringle. Harlan knew all three names. He doubted if one Eternal out of 100,000 had heard of any one of them. Harlan took a secret, shame-faced pride in this sort of arcane knowledge. From his earliest days in school, he had ridden the hobby horse of primitive history, and educator Yarrow had encouraged it. Harlan had grown actually fond of those odd, perverted centuries that lay not only before the beginning of eternity in the 27th, but even before the invention of the temporal field itself in the 24th. He had used old books and periodicals in his studies. He had even traveled far down when to the earliest centuries of eternity, when he could get permission to consult better sources. For over 15 years, he had managed to collect a remarkable library of his own, almost all in print on paper. There was a volume by a man called H. G. Wells, another by a man named W. Shakespeare, some tattered histories. Best of all, there was a complete set of bound volumes of a primitive news weekly that took up inordinate space, but that he could not, out of sentiment, bear to reduce to microfilm. Occasionally, he would lose himself in a world where life was life, and death, death, where a man made his decisions irrevocably, where evil could not be prevented, nor good promoted, and the Battle of Waterloo, having been lost, was really lost for good and all. There was even a scrap of poetry he treasured, which stated that a moving finger having once written could never be lured back to unwrite. And then it was difficult, almost a shock, to return his thoughts to eternity and to a universe where reality was something flexible and evanescent, something men such as himself could hold in the palms of their hands and shake
into better shape. The illusion of St. Nicholas shattered when Hob Finch spoke to him in a brisk, matter-of-fact way.
You can start in tomorrow with a routine screening of current reality. I want it good, thorough, and to the point. There will be no slackness permitted. Your first spatio-temporal chart will be ready for you tomorrow morning, got it?
Yes, computer, said Harlan.
He decided as early as that he and assistant computer Hob Finch would not get along, and he regretted it. The next morning, Harlan got his chart in intricately punched patterns as they emerged from the computerplex. He used a pocket decoder to translate them into standard intertemporal in his anxiety to make not even the smallest mistake at the very beginning. Of course, he had reached the stage where he could read the perforations direct. The chart told him where and when in the world of the 482nd century he might go, and where he might not, what he could do, and what he could not, what he must avoid at all costs. His presence must impinge only upon those places and times where it would not endanger reality. The 482nd was not a comfortable century for him. It was not like his own, austere and conformist home when. It was an era without ethics or principles, as he was accustomed to think of such. It was hedonistic, materialistic, more than a little matriarchal. It was the only era, he checked this in the records in the most painstaking way, in which ectogenic birth flourished. And, at its peak, 40% of its women gave eventual birth by merely contributing a fertilized ovum to the ovaria. Marriage was made and unmade by mutual consent and was not recognized legally as anything more than a personal agreement without binding force. Union for the sake of childbearing was, of course, carefully differentiated from the social functions of marriage, and was arranged on purely eugenic principles. In 100 ways, Harlan thought the society sick, and therefore hungered for a reality change. More than once, it occurred to him that his own presence in the century, as a man not of that time, could fork its history. If his disturbing presence could only be made disturbing enough at some key point, a different branch of possibility would become real. A branch in which millions of pleasure-seeking women would find themselves transformed into true, pure-hearted mothers. They would be in another reality with all the memories that belonged with it, unable to tell, dream, or fancy that they had ever been anything else. Unfortunately, to do that, he would have to step outside the bounds of the spatio-temporal chart, and that was unthinkable. Even if it weren't, to step outside the bounds at random could change reality in many possible ways. It could be made worse. Only careful analysis and computing could properly pinpoint the nature of a reality change. Outwardly, whatever his private opinions, Harlan remained an observer, and the ideal observer was merely a set of sense-perceptive nerve patches attached to a report-writing mechanism. Between perception and report, there must be no intervention of emotion. Harlan's reports were perfection itself in that respect. Assistant Computer Finch called him in after his second weekly report.
"I congratulate you, Observer," he said in a voice without warmth, "on the organization and clarity of your reports, but what do you really think?"
Harlan sought refuge in an expression as blank as though chipped painstakingly out of native 95th century wood. He said, "I have no thoughts of my own in the matter."
"Oh, come. You're from the 95th, and we both know what that means. Surely this century disturbs you."
Harlan shrugged. "Does anything in my reports lead you to think that I am disturbed?" It was near to impudence, and the drumming of Finch's blunt nails upon his desk showed it.
Finch said, "Answer my question."
Harlan said, Sociologically, many facets of the century represent an extreme. The last three reality changes in the about when have accentuated that. Eventually, I suppose, the matter should be rectified. Extremes are never healthy. Then you took the trouble to check the past realities of the century. As an observer, I must check all pertinent facts. It was a standoff. Harlan, of course, did have the right and the duty to check those facts. Finge must know that. Every century was continually being shaken by reality changes. No observations, however painstaking, could ever stand for long without rechecking. It was standard procedure in eternity to have every century in a chronic state of being observed. And to observe properly, you must be able to present not only the facts of the current reality, but also of their relationship to those of previous realities. Yet it seemed obvious to Harlan that this was not merely unpleasantness on Finge's part, this probing of the observer's opinions. Finge seemed definitely hostile. At another time, Finge said to Harlan, having invaded the latter's small office to bring the news, "Your reports are creating a very favorable impression with the Alwyn Council." Harlan paused, uncertain, then mumbled, "Thank you." "All agree that you show an uncommon degree of penetration." "I do my best." Finge asked suddenly, "Have you ever met Senior Computer Twistle?" "Computer Twistle?" Harlan's eyes widened. "No, sir, why do you ask?" "He seems particularly interested in your reports." Finge's round cheeks drew downward, sulkily, and he changed the subject. "To me, it seems that you have worked out a philosophy of your own, a viewpoint of history." Temptation tugged hard at Harlan. Vanity and caution battled, and the former won. "I've studied primitive history, sir."
"Primitive history? At school?"
"Not exactly, computer. On my own, it's my hobby. It's like watching history standing still, frozen. It can be studied in detail, whereas the centuries of eternity are always changing." He warmed up a trifle at the thought of it. "It's as though we were to take a series of stills from a book film and study each painstakingly. We would see a great deal we would miss if we just scanned the film as it went past. I think that helps me a great deal with my work." Finge stared at him in amazement, widened his eyes a little, and left with no further remark. Occasionally, thereafter, he brought up the subject of primitive history and accepted Harlan's reluctant comments with no decisive expression on his own plump face. Harlan was not sure whether to regret the whole matter or to regard it as a possible way of speeding his own advancement. He decided on the first alternative when, passing him one day in Corridor A, Finge said abruptly and in the hearing of others,
"Great time, Harlan. Don't you ever smile?"
The thought came, shockingly to Harlan, that Finge hated him. His own feeling for Finge approached something like detestation thereafter. 3 months of raking through the 482nd had exhausted most of its worthwhile meat, and when Harlan received a sudden call to Finge's office, he was not surprised. He was expecting a change in assignment. His final summary had been prepared days before. The 482nd was anxious to export more cellulose-based textiles to centuries which were deforested, such as the 1174th, but were unwilling to accept smoked fish in return. A long list of such items was contained in due order and with due analysis. He took the draft of the summary with him. But no mention of the 482nd was made. Instead, Finge introduced him to a withered and wrinkled little man with sparse white hair and a gnome-like face that, throughout the interview, was stamped with a perpetual smile. It varied between extremes of anxiety and joviality, but never quite disappeared. Between two of his yellow-stained fingers lay a burning cigarette. It was the first cigarette Harlan had ever seen. Otherwise, he would have paid more attention to the man, less to the smoking cylinder, and been better prepared for Finge's introduction. Finge said, "Senior Computer Twistle, this is Observer Andrew Harlan." Harlan's eyes shifted in shock from the little man's cigarette to his face. Senior Computer Twistle said, in a high-pitched voice,
"How do you do? So this is the young man who writes those excellent reports."
Harlan found no voice. Laban Twistle was a legend, a living myth. Laban Twistle was a man he should have recognized at once. He was the outstanding computer in eternity, which was another way of saying he was the most eminent eternal alive. He was the dean of the All-Wen Council. He had directed more reality changes than any men in the history of eternity. Harlan's mind failed him altogether. He nodded his head with a doltish grin and said nothing. Twistle put his cigarette to his lips, puffed quickly, and took it away.
"Leave us, Finge. I want to talk to the boy."
Finge rose, murmured something, and left. Twistle said,
"You seem nervous, boy. There is nothing to be nervous about."
But meeting Twistle like that was a shock. It is always disconcerting to find that someone you have thought of as a giant is actually less than 5.5 feet tall. Could the brain of a genius actually fit behind the retreating, bald, smooth forehead? Was it sharp intelligence, or only good humor that beamed out of the little eyes that screwed up into 1,000 wrinkles? Harlan didn't know what to think. The cigarette seemed to obscure what small scrabble of intelligence he could collect. He flinched visibly as a puff of smoke reached him. Twistle's eyes narrowed as though he were trying to peer through the smoke haze, and he said, in horribly accented 10th millennial dialect,
"Will you better feel if I in yourself dialect should speech boy?"
Harlan, brought to the sudden brink of hysterical laughter, said carefully, "I speak standard intertemporal quite well, sir." He said it in the intertemporal he and all other Eternals in his presence had used ever since his first months in eternity.
"Nonsense," said Twistle imperiously. "I do not bother of intertemporal. My speech of 10 millennial is over than perfect."
Harlan guessed that it had been some 40 years since Twistle had had to make use of local Wen dialects. But having made his point to his own satisfaction, apparently, he shifted to intertemporal and remained there. He said,
"I would offer you a cigarette, but I am certain you don't smoke. Smoking is approved of hardly any Wen in history. In fact, good cigarettes are made only in the 72nd, and mine have to be specially imported from there. I give you that hint in case you ever become a smoker. It is all very sad. Last week, I was stuck in the 123rd for 2 days. No smoking. I mean, even in the section of eternity devoted to the 123rd. The Eternals there have picked up the mores. If I lit a cigarette, it would have been like the sky collapsing. Sometimes I think I should like to calculate one great reality change and wipe out all the no-smoking taboos in all the centuries. Except that any reality change like that would make for wars in the 58th or a slave society in the 1000th. Always something."
Harlan was first confused, then anxious. Surely these rattling irrelevancies must be hiding something. His throat felt a little constricted. He said,
"May I ask why you've arranged to see me, sir?"
"I like your reports, boy."
There was a veiled glimmer of joy in Harlan's eyes, but he did not smile. "Thank you, sir."
"It has a touch of the artist. You are intuitive. You feel strongly. I think I know your proper position in eternity, and I have come to offer it to you."
Harlan thought, "I can't believe this." He held all triumph out of his voice.
You do me great honor, sir, he said.
Whereupon Senior Computer Twistle, having come to the end of his cigarette, produced another in his left hand by some unnoted feat of legerdemain and lit it. He said between puffs,
For time's sake, boy, you talk as though you rehearsed lines. Great honor, bah! Piffle, trash! Say what you feel in plain language. You're glad, hey?
Yes, sir, said Harlan cautiously.
All right. You should be. How would you like to be a technician?
A technician? Cried Harlan, leaping from his seat.
Sit down, sit down. You seem surprised.
I hadn't expected to be a technician, Computer Twistle.
No, said Twistle dryly. Somehow no one ever does. They expect anything but that. Yet technicians are hard to find, and are always in demand. Not a section in eternity has what it considers enough.
I don't think I'm suited.
You mean you're not suited to take a job with trouble in it? By time! If you are devoted to eternity, as I believe you are, you won't mind that. So the fools will avoid you, and you will feel ostracized. You will grow used to that. And you will have the satisfaction of knowing you are needed, and needed badly. By me.
By you, sir? By you particularly?
Yes.
An element of shrewdness entered the old man's smile.
You are not to be just a technician. You will be my personal technician. You will have special status. How does that sound now?
Harlan said, I don't know, sir. I may not qualify.
Twistle shook his head firmly.
I need you. I need just you. Your reports assure me you have what I need up here.
He tapped his forehead quickly with a ridge-nailed forefinger.
Your record as cub is good. The sections for which you have observed reported favorably. Finally, Finge's report was most suitable of all.
Harlan was honestly startled.
Computer Finge's report was favorable?
You didn't expect that.
I don't know.
Well, boy, I didn't say it was favorable. I said it was suitable. As a matter of fact, Finge's report was not favorable. He recommended that you be removed from all duties connected with reality changes. He suggested it wasn't safe to keep you anywhere but in maintenance.
Harlan reddened.
What were his reasons for saying so, sir?
It seems you have a hobby, boy. You are interested in primitive history, eh?
He gestured expansively with his cigarette, and Harlan, forgetting in his anger to control his breathing, inhaled a cloud of smoke and coughed helplessly. Twistle regarded the young observer's coughing spell benignly and said,
Isn't that so?
Harlan began,
Computer Finge had no right.
Now, now. I told you what was in the report because it hinges on the purpose I need you most for. Actually, the report was confidential, and you are to forget I told you what was in it. Permanently, boy.
But what's wrong with being interested in primitive history?
Finge thinks your interest in it shows a strong wish to time. You understand me, boy?
Harlan did. It was impossible to avoid picking up psychiatric lingo. That phrase, above all. Every member of eternity was supposed to have a strong drive, the stronger for being officially suppressed in all its manifestations, to return, not necessarily to his own time, but at least to some one definite time, to become part of a century, rather than to remain a wanderer through them all. Of course, in most Eternals, the drive remained safely hidden in the unconscious.
I don't think that's the case, said Harlan.
Nor I. In fact, I think your hobby is interesting and valuable. As I said, it's why I want you. I want you to teach a cub I shall bring to you all you know and all you can learn about primitive history. In between, you will also be my personal technician. You'll start in a few days. Is that agreeable?
Agreeable? To have official permission to learn all he could about the days before eternity? To be personally associated with the greatest eternal of them all? Even the nasty fact of technician status seemed bearable under those conditions. His caution, however, did not entirely fail him. He said, "If it's necessary for the good of eternity, sir."
"For the good of eternity?" cried the gnomish computer in sudden excitement.
He threw his cigarette butt from him with such energy that it hit the far wall and bounced off in a shower of sparks.
"I need you for the existence of eternity."
Chapter 3 Cub. Harlan had been in the 575th for weeks before he met Brinsley Sheridan Cooper. He had time to grow used to his new quarters and to the antisepsis of glass and porcelain. He learned to wear the technician's mark with only moderate shrinking, and to refrain from making things worse by standing so that the insignia was hidden against a wall or was covered by the interposition of some object he was carrying. Others smiled disdainfully when that was done and turned colder, as though they suspected an attempt to invade their friendship on false pretenses. Senior Computer Twistle brought him problems daily. Harlan studied them and wrote his analyses in drafts that were four times rewritten, the last version being handed in reluctantly even so. Twistle would appraise them and nod and say,
"Good, good."
Then his cold blue eyes would dart quickly at Harlan, and his smile would narrow a bit as he said,
"I'll test this guess on the computerplex."
He always called the analysis a guess. He never told Harlan the result of the computerplex check, and Harlan dared not ask. He was despondent over the fact that he was never asked to put any of his own analyses into action. Did that mean that the computerplex was not checking him, that he had been choosing the wrong item for the induction of a reality change, that he did not have the knack of seeing the minimum necessary change in an indicated range? It was not until later that he grew sufficiently sophisticated to have the phrase come rolling off his tongue as MNC. One day, Twistle came in with an abashed individual who seemed scarcely to dare raise his eyes to meet Harlan's. Twistle said,
"Technician Harlan, this is Cub B.S. Cooper."
Automatically, Harlan said, "Hello," weighed the man's appearance, and was unimpressed. The fellow was on the shortish side, with dark hair parted in the middle. His chin was narrow, his eyes an indefinite light brown, his ears a little large, and his fingernails bitten. Twistle said,
"This is the boy to whom you will be teaching primitive history."
"Great time," said Harlan, with suddenly increased interest. "Hello," he had almost forgotten. Twistle said,
"Arrange a schedule with him that will suit you, Harlan. If you can manage 2 afternoons a week, I think that would be fine. Use your own method of teaching him. I'll leave that to you. If you should need book films or old documents, tell me, and if they exist in eternity or in any part of time that can be reached, we'll get them. Eh, boy?"
He plucked a lit cigarette out of nowhere, as it always seemed, and the air reeked with smoke. Harlan coughed, and from the twisting of the cub's mouth, it was quite obvious that the latter would have done the same had he dared. After Twistle left, Harlan said, "Well, sit down." He hesitated a moment, then added determinedly, "Son, sit down, son. My office isn't much, but it's yours whenever we're together." Harlan was almost flooded with eagerness. This project was his. Primitive history was something that was all his own. The cub raised his eyes, for the first time, really, and said stumblingly,
"You are a technician."
A considerable part of Harlan's excitement and warmth died.
"What of it?"
"Nothing," said the cub.
I just...
You heard Computer Twistle address me as technician, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
Did you think it was a slip of the tongue, something too bad to be true?
No, sir.
What's wrong with your speech? Harlan asked brutally, and even as he did so, he felt shame nudge him. Cooper blushed painfully.
I'm not very good at standard intertemporal.
Why not? How long have you been a cub?
Less than 1 year, sir.
1 year? How old are you, for time's sake?
24 physio years, sir.
Harlan stared. Are you trying to tell me that they took you into eternity at 23?
Yes, sir.
Harlan sat down and rubbed his hands together. That just wasn't done. 15 to 16 was the age of entrance into eternity. What was this? A new kind of testing of himself on the part of Twistle? He said, "Sit down and let's get started. Your name in full and your home when?" The cub stammered.
"Brinsley Sheridan Cooper of the 78th, sir."
Harlan almost softened. That was close. It was only 17 centuries downwind from his own home when. Almost a temporal neighbor. He said, "Are you interested in primitive history?"
"Computer Twistle asked me to learn. I don't know much about it."
"What else are you learning?"
"Mathematics. Temporal engineering. I'm just getting the fundamentals so far. Back in the 78th, I was a speedevac repairman."
There was no point in asking the nature of a speedevac. It might be a suction cleaner, a computing machine, a type of spray painter, anything. Harlan wasn't particularly interested. He said, "Do you know anything about history? Any kind of history?"
"I studied European history."
"Your particular political unit, I take it."
"I was born in Europe, yes. Mostly, of course, they taught us modern history. After the revolutions of 54, 75-54, that is."
"All right. First thing you do is to forget it. It doesn't mean anything. The history they try to teach timers changes with every reality change. Not that they realize that. In each reality, their history is the only history. That's what's so different about primitive history.
That's the beauty of it.
No matter what any of us does, it exists precisely as it has always existed. Columbus and Washington, Mussolini and Hereford, they all exist." Cooper smiled feebly. He brushed his little finger across his upper lip, and for the first time, Harlan noticed a trace of bristle there as though the cub were cultivating a mustache.
Cooper said, "I can't quite get used to it, all the time I've been here."
"Get used to what?"
"Being 500 centuries away from home when."
"I'm nearly that myself. I'm 95th.
"That's another thing. You're older than I am, and yet I'm 17 centuries older than you in another way. I can be your great-great-great, and so on, grandfather."
"What's the difference, suppose you are?"
"Well, it takes getting used to."
There was a trace of rebellion in the cub's voice. "It does for all of us," said Harlan callously, and began talking about the primitives. By the time 3 hours had passed, he was deep in an explanation concerning the reasons why there were centuries before the first century.
"But isn't the first century first?" Cooper had asked plaintively.
Harlan ended by giving the cub a book, not a good one really, but one that would serve as a beginning. "I'll get you better stuff as we go along," he said. By the end of a week, Cooper's mustache had become a pronounced dark bristle that made him look 10 years older and accentuated the narrowness of his chin. On the whole, Harlan decided, it would not be an improvement, that mustache. Cooper said,
"I finished your book."
"What did you think of it?"
"In a way..."
There was a long pause. Cooper began over again.
"Parts of the later primitive was something like the 78th. It made me think of home, you know. Twice, I dreamed about my wife."
Harlan exploded. "Your wife?"
"I was married before I came here."
"Great time. Did they bring your wife across too?"
Cooper shook his head. "I don't even know if she's been changed in the last year. If she has, I suppose she's not really my wife now."
Harlan recovered. Of course,
If the cub were 23 years old when he was taken into eternity, it was quite possible that he might have been married. One thing unprecedented led to another. What was going on? Once modifications were introduced into the rules, it wouldn't be a long step to the point where everything would decline into a mass of incoherency. Eternity was too finely balanced an arrangement to endure modification. It was his anger on behalf of Eternity, perhaps, that put an unintended harshness into Harlan's next words. "I hope you're not planning on going back to the 78th to check on her." The cub lifted his head, and his eyes were firm and steady.
"No."
Harlan shifted uneasily. "Good. You have no family, nothing. You're an eternal, and don't ever think of anyone you knew in time." Cooper's lips thinned, and his accent stood out sharply in his quick words.
"You're speaking like a technician."
Harlan's fists clenched along the sides of his desk. He said hoarsely, "What do you imply? I'm a technician, so I make the changes? So I defend them and demand that you accept them? Look, kid, you haven't been here a year. You can't speak intertemporal. You're all misgeared on time and reality, but you think you know all about technicians and how to kick them in the teeth."
"I'm sorry," said Cooper quickly. "I didn't mean to offend you."
No, who offends a technician? You just hear everyone else talking, is that it? They say cold as a technician's heart, don't they? They say a trillion personalities change, just a technician's yawn, maybe a few other things. What's the answer, Mr. Cooper? Does it make you feel sophisticated to join in? It makes you a big man? A big wheel in eternity?
I said I'm sorry.
All right. I just want you to know I've been a technician for less than a month and I personally have never induced a reality change. Now let's get on with business.
Senior computer Twistle called Andrew Harlan to his office the next day. He said,
"How would you like to go on an MNC, boy?"
It was almost too apposite.
All that morning, Harlan had been regretting his cowardly disclaimer of personal involvement in the technician's work. His childish cry of, "I haven't done anything wrong yet, so don't blame me."
It amounted to an admission that there was something wrong about a technician's work, and that he himself was blameless only because he was too new at the game to have had time to be a criminal. He welcomed the chance to kill that excuse now. It would be almost a penance. He could say to Cooper, "Yes, because of something I have done, this many millions of people are new personalities, but it was necessary, and I am proud to have been the cause." So Harlan said joyfully, "I'm ready, sir."
"Good, good. You'll be glad to know, boy."
A puff, and the cigarette tip glowed brilliantly.
"That every one of your analyses checked out with high-order accuracy."
"Thank you, sir." They were analyses now, thought Harlan, not guesses.
"You've got a talent. Quite a touch, boy. I look for great things. And we can begin with this one. 223rd, your statement that a jammed vehicle clutch would supply the necessary fork without undesirable side effects is perfectly correct. Will you jam it?"
"Yes, sir."
That was Harlan's true initiation into technicianhood. After that, he was more than just a man with a rose-red badge. He had handled reality. He had tampered with a mechanism during a quick few minutes taken out of the 223rd, and, as a result, a young man did not reach a lecture on mechanics he had meant to attend. He never went in for solar engineering, consequently, and a perfectly simple device was delayed in its development a crucial 10 years. A war in the 224th, amazingly enough, was moved out of reality as a result. Wasn't that good? What if personalities were changed? The new personalities were as human as the old and as deserving of life. If some lives were shortened, more were lengthened and made happier. A great work of literature,
A monument of man's intellect and feeling was never written in the new reality, but several copies were preserved in Eternity's libraries, were they not? And new creative works had come into existence, had they not? Yet that night, Harlan spent hours in a hot agony of wakefulness, and when he finally drowsed, groggily, he did something he hadn't done in years. He dreamed of his mother.